on the show today, how entrepreneurs are transforming the South African township of Soweto. Our correspondent Sally Sara discovers it's more than a leap of faith. Challenges for Taiwan's manufacturers as they struggle to compete with China. Those stories shortly, but first, have you ever wondered what it's like to follow a prime minister on an official overseas visit just a few months out from an election? Well, it's frantic, according to political reporter and aspiring foreign correspondent James Glenday. James found himself in Indonesia this week on his first overseas assignment with the newly reinstalled PM, Kevin Rudd. James battled traffic jams, an unreliable phone network, and a stomach bug. But of course, he survived and filed this report from Jakarta.
When the Labor leadership drama finally erupted, I'll admit I was slightly concerned. Would I still get to go to Jakarta? "We've just axed another leader, what more do you effing want?" opined a senior Labor spin doctor. It's a fair point, but I was mightily relieved when it was announced the visit would take place, albeit with a constantly evolving itinerary, which is code for "we've just taken over" and sort of making this up as we go along. Jakarta's traffic is ridiculous. It took hours to get anywhere, even with a police motorcade, and my enthusiasm was dampened slightly by the humidity and frantic pace.
Saya senang berada di Jakarta, terima kasih, and I look forward to your questions.
He's called Kevin 24/7 for a reason, and despite all his recent mea culpas, there doesn't appear to have been that much change. He zipped from a brief private briefing with journalists to a short press conference, a dinner with his good mate President Yudhoyono, a business breakfast, a trip to the country, a visit to a palace, bilateral talks, another media statement, a quick lunch, a handshake, a hug, and then take off, all within 24 hours. The press pack was left waiting or frantically filing. I looked up to find myself doing a cross for our PM program in the grounds of the opulent Summer Palace in Bogor, surrounded by small, fat deer, while poor, skinny children watched on through the fence. There were a few hiccups. The internet began crashing when everyone wanted to file. Phone conversations were cut short by a telecommunication system that rarely ceased to fail. The main press conference was held right before major deadlines, and I drank water out of a tap. What a big, big mistake. However, all in all, Indonesia seems like a fascinating country. The people were lovely, and from what I saw out of the bus window, I'd love the chance to go back to Java again. But right now, I'm going to take the PM's advice and have a Bex and a good lie down. If Kevin Rudd keeps up this pace for the coming election campaign, Iron Man Tony Abbott will need every last bit of his strength. This is James Glenday in Jakarta, filing for the first and hopefully not last time for Correspondence Report.
The death, destruction and horror that accompanies war also seems to generate great works of art, literature and music. The Vietnam War inspired a generation of artists both in the United States and here in Australia. Diplomat-cum-songwriter Fred Smith uses music to tell of the experiences of Australia's troops fighting in Afghanistan. As a diplomat, he's done several stints at Australia's main military base there in Taran Kot. He shared a lot with the diggers, including the pain and loss when they lose one of their comrades. South Asia correspondent Michael Edwards caught up with Fred Smith when he was in Taran Kot.
Just to get into the joint, there are push-ups and procedures, and there was death by PowerPoint.
It's sundown in Taran Kot. A gentle breeze wafts through the Australian base here. And even light is generating a golden hue. It's clear enough that you can make out the nooks and crannies of Uruzgan's mountains that sit off in the distance. A large group of soldiers and diplomats are sitting around the courtyard of the base's coffee shop. Despite the assault rifles slung across their backs and the pistols by their sides, it's a rare moment to relax. They're listening to a live performance from Fred Smith, a diplomat come songwriter. This song is called The Dust of Uruzgan.
Well, it took 7 months of training just to get into the joint. There were push-ups and procedures, and there was death by PowerPoint. And then the RSONI course in Ali al-Salam. But nothing can prepare you for the dust of Uruzgan. Me and Benny sat together, flying into Kandahar.
Fred has a busy day job working with the provincial reconstruction team here in Uruzgan. But whenever he gets a second of free time, he's on his guitar writing songs. He describes it as his songwriting addiction, and his inspirations are the men and women living and fighting in Uruzgan.
These young engineers,
job is to clear the road so we may pass.
Sapper's Lullaby sings of the death of combat engineers, soldiers with the perilous job of clearing landmines and improvised explosive devices.
Sapper D. Smith had a wife and a son, the apple of his eye. Snowy Morland was just 21, way too young to die. Sing me your sapper's lullaby. You give it your all, knowing if you should fall, that all the things must die.
But he also captures the perhaps unintended humour that comes with military life. For years, Australian troops shared the Tarin Kot base with the Dutch military.
I respect your lowlands culture and I love you very much, but there is one important thing I say to all you Dutch.
2, 3, 4, neat, slopping up the big sea. It's against the law. Neat, slopping up the big sea. We're trying to fight it.
You might not know what swaffling is, and I can't explain it here, but let's just say those in Amsterdam's famous red light district would certainly realise what I'm talking about. Dutch troops reputedly got a kick out of swaffling in the base's portable toilets, or so Fred Smith tells me. Anyway, he wrote a song about it.
If I hear that you've been swaffling in that Dixie, I'll tell Brigadier Van Hoon. And he'll have you court-martialed and sent back to the Hague, where they'll put your dick on a table and whack it with a spade. So knit, swapping up that dick, say knit, 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 swapping up that dick, say.
After his concert, young soldiers crowd around him. He's selling copies of his CD, which they're buying. They want his autograph, and some have their photos taken with him. It looks as though he's a musician who has been specially flown in for the performance. But the soldiers know Fred well from around the base. They tell me they respect the fact Fred lives with them and knows what they're going through.
He knew how to, you know, really write about current topics and, you know, what's been going on. So, yeah, really enjoyed it.
He's got a good understanding of what's going on here and all that. And that makes it all the more better because he really kind of captures what we're going through and sums it up really well. And it's good music behind it as well.
Songs about the Vietnam War have given a whole chapter to the history of music. Red Gum's I Was Only 19 is probably our most memorable song, written describing the war's impact on soldiers and Australian society in general. Fred Smith is a big believer in music's ability to encapsulate history, but he says all he wants to do is tell the soldiers' stories.
In these songs, what I'm trying to convey, well, what I'm conveying is just people's stories, just individual stories and things that have happened to people out here, and like all storytelling, the most specific is the most general. So I try to keep the specifics and let people come around with their own conclusions about stuff.
Up from the road to down past the gate, out to the flight line, we stood in the sun, slouch hat and gun, there's two caskets.
Australian troops will be out of Oruz Gan by the end of the year. What they've done during their time here is well documented across television and radio, and books have been written about it. But perhaps it's the sentiments that are harder to capture, something Fred Smith hopes he does with his songs. This is Michael Edwards for Correspondence Report.
Sapper's lullaby, all good things must die.
Taiwan is famous for being one of the world's leading manufacturers of LCD panels and for being home to brands such as the mobile phone company HTC. But while these may be outward symbols of success, the island once dubbed one of Asia's four tiger economies has drifted from its economic heyday, even though it signed a significant economic agreement with mainland China in 2010. Hui Fern Tay recently travelled from Beijing to Taipei to see what's changed.
I recently flew direct from Beijing to Taipei in just 3 hours. This journey was not possible prior to 2008 because direct shipping, air and postal links between mainland China and Taiwan had been banned for 6 decades since the end of the Civil War in 1949. Flights were limited to chartered services and included a stopover in a third location such as Hong Kong. Other things that had changed included the number of mainland Chinese tourists. They account for around half the number of monthly visitors to Taipei 101, one of the world's tallest buildings. Taiwan is also selling more to mainland China ever since a significant economic agreement was signed in 2010. But its export-oriented economy has slowed, and growth is forecast to be even slower this year. That's bad news for Taiwanese who are looking for an economic breakthrough because the island has lost its competitiveness. This brings me to something that has changed very little: salaries. These have barely risen since 2001. It stresses locals who want to buy a home, and that's most of them. Henry Zhang is an entrepreneur in Taipei who is trained in industrial design. He gave us his take on why low salaries have persisted for so long.
It's actually a negative cycle because there was this sudden demand in students wanting to study design, but they weren't enough designers in Taiwan to begin with. So almost all the designers became instructors or lecturers or professors in design. And since there are a lot of, we think, unqualified designers out there who are teaching students, and the schools have no idea how to set rules for design education. And therefore, the students taught by those designers, they come out unprepared and unqualified, and they enter the market, and the market doesn't really know how to choose designers because they didn't have the chance to work with them before. So it's like an infinite loop and just keep on going and going, and it's snowballing to this huge mess.
The brain drain from Taiwan is a consequence of low salaries. It remains a problem, even though the talent outflow isn't as bad as it was in the 60s and 70s. As I boarded the return flight to Beijing, I met an elderly woman who now lives in London together with her children who had grown up in Taiwan. Would they return to Taiwan, I asked. They'd like to, she says, but how can they if they have to take a massive pay cut? This is Hui Fen Tay in Beijing for Correspondence Report.
Indonesia has invited the foreign ministers of 4 Pacific Island countries to visit its 2 easternmost provinces, Papua and West Papua, to see for themselves if the people want independence. Those 2 provinces are the western half of the main island of New Guinea. This offer is something of a diplomatic manoeuvre, successfully delaying any consideration by the Melanesian spearhead group, the MSG, of an application for full membership by the West Papua National Coalition for Liberation. Pacific correspondent Sean Dorney went to the 2-yearly meeting of the leaders of Melanesia's sub-regional organisation held this year in New Caledonia.
25 years ago, the 4 independent countries in Melanesia, Fiji, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, created a sub-regional organisation, the Melanesian Spearhead Group, and one of its aims was to help the Melanesian people of New Caledonia, the Kanaks, get their independence from France. That has not happened yet, but France did agree to allow the Kanak Independence Movement, the FLNKS, to take up full membership of the Melanesian group. Now, the Melanesian Independence Movement in West Papua, the Indonesian half of the main island of New Guinea, wants to join. At the MSG's plenary session in Noumea, Dr. Otto Ondawami, the vice chairman of the West Papua National Coalition for Liberation, put their case.
Our delegation come here as a lost son of Melanesia to come here to ask for your support. We must unite and find a viable alternative to solve the longest conflict in our region.
Indonesia took control of what had been to then Dutch New Guinea in 1963, and 6 years later gathered just over 1,000 tribal leaders together to vote in favour of becoming part of Indonesia. It was called an act of free choice, which the United Nations accepted. Paula Makabori from the Institute of Papuan Advocacy and Human Rights was part of the West Papuan delegation.
Yeah, I think with all of this, the MSG recognized that the act of free choice was a shameful choice for West Papua.
At the official opening of the Melanesian Spearhead Group leaders' meeting, the outgoing chairman, Fiji's military commander and Prime Minister, Commodore Frank Bainimarama, spoke of unity.
As a result of our shared vision for closer regional integration, MSG solidarity has never been stronger.
But Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, visited Indonesia instead of attending the MSG meeting, while his stand-in, the Deputy Prime Minister Leo Dion, made it clear to the other MSG leaders that PNG regarded West Papua as an integral part of Indonesia. Fiji revealed that Indonesia had offered to host a visit by Melanesian foreign ministers, and so Fiji suggested the membership application by the West Papuans be put on hold. Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Moana Kakasis, made an impassioned plea on behalf of the West Papuans, and Sir Michael Somare, invited as an elder statesman, summed up the situation well, although he was not referring directly to West Papua.
In Melanesia, we are also very divided. We are not united. We have to unite. The only course we can take is when we are united people, you can beat your enemy.
In the end, the communique said the West Papuan's application would be considered after the foreign ministers of the MSG countries visited Indonesia. However, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu insisted on the inclusion of two critical sentences. The first said that leaders endorsed that the MSG fully supports the inalienable rights of the people of West Papua towards self-determination. And the second said the leaders agreed that the concerns of the MSG regarding the human rights violations and other forms of atrocities relating to the West Papuan people be raised with the government of Indonesia. The reactions of the West Papuan delegation to the communique were mixed. Dr. Otto Ondawami was relieved.
We are very happy that our application not been thrown out, but is still there on the agenda of MSG.
But the Secretary-General of the West Papua National Coalition for Liberation, Rex Rumakiek, doubted the value of a ministerial trip to Indonesia.
They will come back empty-handed. They won't see people that they wanted to see. And that means it's a waste of time. You could have make a decision right now instead of going to Indonesia.
The Melanesian foreign minister's visit to Jakarta and the Papuan provinces should take place before the end of the year. This has been Sean Dorney for Correspondence Report.
For decades, it had a reputation as a place of poverty and unrest. Soweto is the most famous township in South Africa and was at the centre of the struggle against apartheid. But now it's a lively city with a population of more than 3.5 million people. Sowetan entrepreneurs are turning some of its landmarks into tourist attractions to draw in visitors and much-needed business. Sally Sara reports from Soweto.
Get ready, the soldiers say. You better get ready.
We're on our way up to the highest point in Soweto. It's the top of the cooling towers of the old Orlando Power Station. What could be an eyesore has been turned into a tourist attraction.
We are in a crazy world. Everyone must go crazy.
This is the home of bungee jumping in Soweto.
I was excited at first, but now I'm feeling a bit, okay.
Pomlilo Maja is about to bungee jump to celebrate her 23rd birthday.
But if I start shivering, it's not me, it's just the wind.
It's just cold.
Yes.
Young Sowetans have been trained to run the operation. 26-year-old Sapiwe is one of the jump crew.
So as we go up, you'll see, I'll be happy to show you my office.
Is your family happy about this job, Sapiwe?
You know, no one is happy. That includes my friends too. Because they always like ask me. Woo.
Sorry. When the cage reaches the top of the cooling tower, it's time to get out.
Oh, that's my bungee right there.
The jumping platform is part of a suspension bridge between the two cooling towers. It's more than 100 metres above the ground. Sapiwe and the crew put on some music to get the jumpers in the mood to take the leap.
Can't you see I'm scared? You're supposed to be my father.
Supervisor Mahali Motse has more than 30 jumps to his name. Initially, there was scepticism from many of the locals when bungee jumping started here in 2008. But this operation is part of a growing tourist industry in Soweto. A lot of imagination and initiative is going into the transformation of the township. Mahali Motse says Soweto still has an image problem with some tourists.
Because if you ask like a tourist like to go to Soweto, you'd say, what, Soweto? They drive up the neighbourhood with the windows higher up now. But nowadays there's so much of a community and there's so much of them coming through, they can drive up with the windows low playing music.
But there's also a growing demand for adventure and entertainment from young locals with money. The size of the black middle class in South Africa has doubled in less than a decade. That's $44 billion worth of spending each year. There are more and more Sowetans with disposable income who want to take the plunge.
That's so brave, baby!
Pomlilo Maja says young Sowetans have more freedom than ever before and want to test the boundaries.
You know, we're not like our parents anymore. We want to go jump everything, you know? It's a great experience. I think more people should actually try these kind of things, yeah.
The old Orlando cooling towers are as much a part of the Sowetan skyline as the Harbour Bridge is to Sydney. These towers were once a sign of industrial decay, but now they're part of the changing face of Soweto.
Sally Sara reporting there. It goes without saying that foreign correspondents spend a lot of time in airports. Caught by bad weather on the way back from an assignment recently, our North America correspondent Jane Cowan found herself marooned in a departure lounge in Minneapolis, where she got chatting to one of the army of people who spend their entire working lives in transit.
One of the cheeriest people I ever met was working in an airport bathroom in a nondescript city somewhere in Middle America. I can't even remember where. Her job was literally to hand people towels at the wash basins and clean the toilets. But she had the biggest, brightest smile I've ever seen, and she flashed it regardless of whether you put anything in her tip jar. The other day I met another one of these inordinately upbeat souls, again working in an airport, this time as a waiter in a chain restaurant. You know the type, lots of hamburgers and fries, his all-day view a glare-filled tarmac. But he was anything but ordinary.
How's it going? I am Gilmore, as in Happy Gilmore. Full name is Gilmore Harris.
His fingernails were painted a dozen different colours, and his glasses were coated with glitter like he was on the way to a fancy dress party. Everything he said was a pun, with well-timed flourishes towards either the glasses or the nails.
Are you having a spectacular time? Speaking of glasses, I am a very glassy guy. I mean, am I nailing this? It's funny because it all started with the specs, because I would wear different specs. And then one day I did the nails, and then I have customers that come in just to see what different specs I have and what different colors. So it's a whole spectrum of different colors. About 99% of the people find it refreshing. Like today is very dreary out, a lot of cancellations. And so I've put a lot of sunshine into a lot of people's day, at least in my day anyway.
You obviously enjoy your job.
I enjoy life, and it comes through my work ethic, yes.
They say that comedians are often very funny when they're on stage, but in their own life it can be quite serious. Is it like that with you?
Well, comedy, you know, laughter is inexpensive medicine. And what I'm doing is I'm healing myself. You know, I mean, I'm experiencing life just like everybody else. I'm going through the stress and fatigues and the traumas that everyone else goes through, except that my way of dealing with that is true laughter. And it's not interesting talking about being serious. It's more interesting being happy and funny.
His mood was infectious, even amongst tired travellers.
Definitely eccentric.
Yeah, eccentric. He's awesome.
Yeah, fun.
I'm in this airport probably twice a month. Gilmore always puts a smile on my face. Doesn't matter, it always makes your day better.
Well, I'm so honoured. One of the few times I'm at a loss of words.
Do you ever get to travel much yourself?
I'm working on that, yeah. Let's just say that's up in the air. How's that?
Happy Gilmore. See you next time. I'm in transit in Minnesota. This is Jane Cowan for Correspondence Report.
That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Simon Santo. Join us at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's foreign correspondents.